Welcome to the Iron Butterfly Podcast. My name is Megan Jaffer.
And I'm Katie Hopkins, and we will be your hosts.
We created Iron Butterfly Podcast in honor of Eloise Page, the original Iron Butterfly. 80 years ago, Eloise joined the Office of Strategic Services, trailblazing a path for what ultimately became the United States intelligence community. She rose the ranks from secretary to case officer, defying the norms of her time, and eventually became the first female chief of station at CIA. Eloise was known among her colleagues to be a fierce fighter with a core of steel, and she earned the codename Iron Butterfly. Our podcast continues her legacy, inviting the unsung heroines of the United States intelligence community to share their stories with aspiring leaders like you. Women in the intelligence community are special because they have dedicated their lives to studying the whole world. And through conversations with hundreds of women in intelligence over the past few years, we have come to understand that the world is at an inflection point. Women hold a more central role in society than ever before. And at Iron Butterfly Media, we are committed to amplifying authentic voices that inspire women to create wherever they are. So pull up a chair. Our changing world needs new ideas made real, which begins with you. Welcome to Iron Butterfly Podcast.
Hi, it's nice to meet you. My name is Leanne. I became a member of the IC in 1999, actually when I joined the Navy. But I was always very interested in the topic of the community, especially when I was in high school. And I read as many books on the topic as I could like get my hands on. And I was also very interested in World War II, still am, and so became exposed to cryptology and what that was and is. So I graduated from Clemson University, go Tigers, and shortly thereafter went off to officer candidate school to pursue work in that field. I've actually been a defense contractor since 2004, but very much consider this phase of my career to be a continuation of service to my country. And believe it or not, I'm in my 11th year with Blue Halo, and I very much enjoy Blue Halo. One of the things I like about it is we have some fabulous employee resource groups, and one of them that I'm active in is Women of Blue Halo. It's a great opportunity for people to take part in events and charities and things like that and have fun too. So this episode of Iron Butterfly, we are joined by Deborah Plunkett. Deborah is currently CEO of Plunkett Associates, following an esteemed career at NSA, which included roles such as the Director of Information Assurance and a stint at the White House National Security Council as Director of Transnational Threats. Fun fact about Deborah, she was CSI before CSI was cool. She worked in a crime lab in Baltimore in the 80s. She's witty, adventurous, and self-proclaimed introvert, and loves to dive deep into details. She loves reading, sports, outdoor activities, traveling. Deborah, welcome to Iron Butterfly.
Debbie, welcome to Iron Butterfly.
I am thrilled to be here.
We're so excited. And we actually don't know you, which is even more exciting for us because we're going to learn, just like our audience, a little bit more about you today. And we have to give a little bit of a shout out to Sue Gordon because she's the one who introduced us to you.
It's her fault.
It is her fault.
Yeah, it's actually funny though. I think a lot of our listeners probably don't know that a lot of our guests come from recommendations from past guests.
That's right.
That's how come they're always so amazing.
I know. Each one better than the next.
The bar is high. Uh-oh. Already.
So, Debbie, we're just going to jump in if you're okay.
Let's do it.
Okay. So, we love to learn a little bit about who you are personally. And so, I'm wondering if you could start us off and share with us kind of like where you grew up, where are you from? You know, what did you want to be when you grew up? Did you become that or did you find another path? And how eventually did you make your way to a long career in national security?
That's a great start. So I am a native Baltimorean, a native and proud Baltimorean.
Nice.
Grew up in East Baltimore until I was about 16. And then we moved to Northwest Baltimore. I have three sisters. I'm second from the oldest. My parents were very active in our lives. We were very active in church and school. School was a really big deal to both of our parents. My dad did not complete 12th grade. My mom is graduated from 12th grade, but they were really determined that their girls were going to go to college. And so I had a really wonderful childhood. We never had a discussion about if you will go to college. It was always where. Mm. And my parents were by no means wealthy. My dad was a businessman. He initially drove 18-wheelers, tractor-trailers.
Oh, wow.
And then he eventually became the vice president of a big company of tractor-trailers.
That's amazing.
He did, and he owned a busing company. I mean, he was really quite an entrepreneur, quite a provider. And my mom worked on and off throughout my childhood and life, and then ultimately came home, and I guess I was in high school when she stopped working. And she worked in, you know, she was a custodian at Morgan, what is now Morgan State University.
Oh, no. Wow.
She knew all the buildings. She knew all the students. She worked there for a number of years. And so I grew up, you know, just a pretty, a typical life. We had standards in our home. We had rules in our home. We had places we could go and not go.
Mm-hmm.
With my poor dad with four girls really suffered the most. First of all, he suffered because he had a hard time getting into the bathroom. That was a big deal. But he suffered, I think, most because he worried about his girls.
Of course.
Right? He worried about his girls and wanting to make sure that we were making good choices. And anytime anybody in our family, extended family, made a bad choice, boy, we got to hear about it on Sunday morning at breakfast. It was like a topic, right? Oh, just gosh. To remind us that we
You're not going to do
right.
that.
We're not going to be there. So I had a great life growing up. I went to Western High School, which is the oldest still all-girls high school, public in the country.
Oh, my goodness.
And still in existence. And graduated from there, actually, or left there as an 11th grader because I was offered the opportunity to finish my 12th grade year concurrent with my first year of college at Virginia Wesleyan College. So I left high school early, went to Virginia Wesleyan, did sort of 12th grade stuff and first year of college. Played some softball. It was a fairly new school and a fairly new softball team. Played softball, busted my knee badly. Ended up having to come home that summer and have surgery and be in the hospital for a week. And to which my parents said, "You really don't think you're going back to Virginia Wesleyan College with, you know, a mobile cast and physical therapy? That's not going to happen." So I transferred to Towson.
Oh, okay.
And that's where I finished my undergraduate career. Went there to be thinking I was going to be a high school science teacher. Loved high school and thought I loved teaching. And got to my junior year of college and we did something called assistant teaching where they would put you into, you know, a school for just a couple days, half days a week
yeah.
to kind of, before you do the official student teaching. And they put me in a middle school, which was a bad idea because middle schoolers are
tough.
Yeah.
They can be tough.
And I promptly decided that I would not be teaching. And here, but of course, I'm a junior at this point, so what the heck? What am I going to do? So I finished that degree program and got it. And the degree was in natural science, but I was qualified to teach middle school and high school science. Instead, I started dating my now husband, who was a teacher. And so I married an educator. I didn't become one, mm-hmm. at that time at least. Went off. I was working at a savings and loan. When I graduated from college, I was doing an internship. When I graduated, I'd gone through a management training program. They offered me the opportunity to manage a branch, which was a pretty big deal for a 21-year-old.
Yeah.
And I jumped on that and did that. Unfortunately, it was right around the savings and loan crisis time. So the savings and loan began to go downhill after about a year and a half. I then thought I should probably use this science degree. So I went to the Baltimore Police Department, where I was a crime lab technician. Like before CSI was cool, I was doing it.
That is cool.
Yep. And so I did, I was on the mobile team. I did, you name it, fatal fires, homicides, the morgue, court testimony, fingerprints, breathalyzer tests, just all of it for 3 years. And then decided this was probably not going to be my life. Rotating shifts, pretty tough. Job.
I mean, it was, I think it's tough
time,
for it tough. A myriad of reasons.
Yes.
You and know, was, emotionally, physically,
right.
all
that's
of
right.
those things.
And so one of my best friends at the time was dating someone who worked at NSA. And he said to me, you know, you should go take the test. I'm like, what do you do? I can't tell you, but you should go take the test. They're giving it at your college. So I went and took the test, and a year later was hired.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have so many questions.
Go ahead. I do too.
So it's funny that just listening to your story, what kind of popped in my head. So our producer, Amanda, and I talk about this all the time. A lot of times when people come on the podcast or you just hear them talk on panels and they talk about getting into the IC, it's like a very linear thing, right? Like, this was something I always wanted to do, or like I just kind of stumbled into this thing, but it was a very straight path. And like, I think sometimes we forget to talk about the like the veers and twists and turns in the road, right? Sure. So you gave us a few of those. One was like, I went to play softball and then busted my knee. Mm-hmm. Two was like, I went to be a teacher, ended up in a middle school class, like absolutely hated it.
Yep.
Then I worked at a savings and loan, and then there was this financial crisis. Like, can you talk a little bit about those twists and turns and like what that was like living through those things?
Sure. I mean, you know, if I reflect back on that time, I don't remember being stressed about them. I really didn't. I don't recall that. Every time it was time for me to make a change, there was an opportunity. And not necessarily one that I created, you know, one that became available to me because somebody said, why don't you? Or because I blindly applied to the Baltimore Police Department because my parents thought, and I thought, I agreed with them, but they did think I should use that science degree. I had some urging. And then it was very clear to me as I got to the 3-year mark at the police department, and my husband and I were at that point engaged to be married. I just couldn't envision myself working these hours and doing this kind of work for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. So I lived, my goodness, not even 15 miles from NSA and had never heard of it, ever heard of it. Wow. In fact, my dad died, I think, thinking I worked at NASA, NASA. And truthfully, during that time, it was much easier to say, yep, that's where I work. Because mm-hmm. everybody knows spaceships and nobody knows spy work. And so, I got really fortunate, blessed to get picked up by NSA. And I remember, taking all the tests and, you know, funny story, of course, you have to get a polygraph at NSA. And I took the polygraph and I don't know, some number of days later, I get a phone call. Woman says, so, you know, this is, you know, the polygraph lady, I don't know, says, we need you to come back and, retake the polygraph. And I'm on the phone and my mom's standing there in the kitchen. I'm like, oh, did I fail? And she said, sweetheart, if you failed, I wouldn't be calling you. So we just need to clear up a couple things. So I did get I got hired and I was in an intern program, which, you know, I don't know, back then, probably 80% of the hires, this was in 1984, everybody was going into an intern program back mm-hmm. then during the Reagan years. And so I had an opportunity to do two different ones, but the one I picked was what's now known as an intelligence analyst. It was called a traffic analyst back then, and I was a special kind. I was a crypto traffic analyst. Mm. So I went through a 3-year program and then got hired into a great organization and would have done that until I retired. That's how much I love the work.
Oh, wow.
Literally, I loved it that much. But
can you explain a little bit of what that means?
I think I probably can. So, a traffic analyst, unlike language analyst, as an example, traffic analysts sort of look at the outside of the envelope. So we're concerned with who sent it and who they sent it to mm-hmm. and what date they sent it and what the addresses are. And so I analyze the externals of messages. Mm-hmm. I never knew the content and didn't really care about the content. Mm. But that was important because many of our foreign adversaries, at that time at least, encoded or encrypted that information. And so my job was to peel that back to reveal the true intent. And it was puzzle work. It was like puzzle work for me. I'm still a puzzler. Like, I still love puzzles. It was detailed work, and I loved it.
It was kind of like the crime lab. I mean, that was puzzle work as well, right? And just in a different way. And now you were just taking it to another level.
Yeah, how about that?
That's super cool.
It's actually an interesting question. Like, how do you think that the things that you did before you went into the intelligence community, like whether that was being at CSI before CSI was cool being a teacher, all these things, like how did, or, you know, science, like mm-hmm. do you look back on those things and say, you know, that was a bit of a detour from intelligence, but like, I really got meaningful things from those experiences?
Sure. I think every one of them leveraged my strengths. And one of my, I think, strengths, everybody doesn't agree with this, but I'm a detail girl. I like the details, whether it is in numbers or it's in data. I like manipulating details, and I like coming up with the answers to details. And so if you think about every single one of those jobs, what required me to be precise.
Yeah.
I could not make mistakes. You couldn't make mistakes in a bank. You really can't make mistakes on a crime scene. And then, you know, you get to NSA and you really shouldn't make mistakes because lives depend on it. Mm.
That doesn't mean I'm superhuman. No,
go ahead.
I feel like you're like buffering. I am.
I have the like wheel that's like, okay, where do I want to go right now? I'm just thinking, you know, you had said something about your dad, even till he passed, probably really didn't know where you worked. And I wonder what your family thought or what your husband thought, because, you know, when you met him, you were going down a different path. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, hey, hon, mm-hmm. I'm going to go work at a spy agency.
Yeah, he was really cool with that. No, he's like, are you going to make money? That's the important thing. Yeah. I'm like, yeah. So he's always been extremely supportive. And he really, you know, I had to have someone like that beside me, because as I progressed through NSA, I traveled a lot. Yeah. I worked mm-hmm. really long hours. And so to have a supportive spouse who was taking care of home and taking care of the kids as needed and, you know, making sure they got a vegetable every once in a while and all that good stuff was just important, critically important.
So how many kids do you have?
We have two adult children, a son and a daughter.
Nice. And are they in this area?
Our daughter is in Maryland, not far from where we live, and our son is in California.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. Very nice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They didn't follow your footsteps in the government?
No, neither did. One is a teacher and the other is in tech sales and is also a music producer.
Oh, very cool. Okay. Mm-hmm. Fancy.
Yeah.
I'm guessing the music producer is in California.
That's right.
So I would love to zoom out from Debbie for just a second. So you are the first person this season that we've had from NSA. So can you give us like a NSA for dummies? Like, what is NSA? How does it differ from some of the other intelligence community agencies? Mm-hmm. Like, what's its mandate? And like, how do you think it's just different or unique?
Sure. So NSA has historically had two primary missions. The first is signals intelligence, and that is looking at foreign communications from foreign entities for the purposes of supporting national security and national decision makers, and of course the warfighter. And then the information assurance, information security, now cybersecurity mission, which is fundamentally focused on protecting national defense, national security systems, but also in, you know, sort of helping those around us understand and respond to threats in the cyber world. So that's fundamentally the difference. You know, NSA has the SIGINT authorities. NSA also has the authority to and responsibility of protecting national security systems.
Well, I was going to ask, so you use the phrase SIGINT. Mm-hmm. Would you mind just defining that for us too?
Sure. I mean, it's signals intelligence. It's it's communications from foreign entities, electronic communications.
Gotcha. That's
probably good.
Okay, cool. So my next question was going to be like, whenever you watch spy movies, like CIA is like the sexy guy, mm-hmm. and NSA is kind of like the evil computer guy. Mm-hmm. Like, why is that? And like, what was your experience?
Yeah, that's a great question. I didn't know this early in my career, but I learned it as I matured and grew through NSA. CIA is phenomenal at promotion of CIA. Mm-hmm. CIA raises professionals who do a phenomenal job of that. And I'm telling you, I can remember when I was actually allowed to say I worked at a place called NSA. We couldn't even, when you gave your phone number, like you couldn't even say, we had to say Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. You couldn't even say the words. And it was a little bit laughable because if you went to a retail industry or store somewhere in the area of Fort Meade, and you start giving your phone number, like, oh, you work at NSA. Like they all knew, but we couldn't say, right? Right.
They're so, like, mm-hmm. Yeah. Like when people say, oh, I work for the State Department. And we're like, okay. Yeah.
The State Department or the State Department?
Yeah.
The real State Department. Yeah. So I think a lot of it is cultural. It's also around, I think it is a part of the personality of NSA to be behind the scenes, to be head down. That doesn't take away from the impact of the work that the agency does, because I've seen statistics that speak to the sourcing of the information that actually lands on the president's desk is significantly from NSA. And so it's not that NSA is not beating down the doors doing phenomenally good work. It's just only within, I mean, I would say maybe the past 10 years that NSA has been more out there, out in the public talking about what they do.
Do you think it's because of some of, you know, like the Edward Snowden events that happened, which kind of forced them to start talking a little bit and being a little bit more open, I guess.
Sure, for sure. Events like that caused some self-reflection with some assistance. so that it really became a change in culture to try to be more open, to invite more more folks into the building. That was also a big, you know, a new big thing, so that they could see, you know, to the extent that we could show what NSA does and how they do it, and especially to talk about the culture of the people and the importance of protecting the rights of U.S. citizens, which is, you know, I don't want to say drummed. It is, you learn it from day one, and it's not even a second thought. You know that's what you have to do. And everybody does, except every once in a while somebody doesn't.
Right. Yeah, we our season premiere this season was a privacy and civil liberties attorney, and we dived in deep about the role and, you know,
just restrictions.
Restrictions and,
protections. Yep.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but the bulk of your career was in, oh my God, I'm totally blanking on the information assurance, correct?
Actually not.
It wasn't?
No. Okay. I spent over 20 years in the SIGINT mission.
Really?
Absolutely. I didn't have my first foray into the information assurance space until 1999, 2000. And that was just a stint, like a diversity tour, literally, because I was in a development program. And so I went there for about a year, but it happened to be 99, 2000. It was because Y2K was happening.
Okay, so then let's back up and let's talk about early in your career and tell us, you know, generally we're not asking specifics, obviously, but
good
like,
thing.
Yeah, just tell us, you know, what were you doing? What you know, what tell us also the roles that you loved and the things you know.
Sure, sure. I mean, I did that crypto traffic analytic work for a couple of years. I became a team chief and then a branch chief, kind of moving through the more junior management levels. And as fate would have it, right around in the 1990 time period, the Soviet Union exploded into some republics. I got some advice at that point that it might be a good idea for me to get out of the bubble I'd been in, a bubble I loved, by the way, and learn about the rest of the missions of the agency and kind of move around some. And so I started doing that, went to corporate relations, where I got the broader view of the agency's mission, went to another core mission area and worked there for a while. And then ultimately, again, good advice was to get a graduate degree. And so I applied and received a graduate fellowship. So I went off to Hopkins, did an MBA program, was gone for 9 months, I guess, came back. Did some other sort of moving up the management. And what I left out a little bit was I had a struggle somewhere in there mid-level about whether I was going to be technical or managerial. It's sort of a classic struggle, which way you're going to go.
And that I think that's a struggle for a lot of people that are, you know, that are, you know, working in the mission, whatever that is, whether they're an engineer or an analyst or whatever, and then they have to make that decision.
That's right.
It's
right.
We've heard from many guests that that's a tough decision.
It is. And so there, of course, benefits to both. I straddled the line for a little bit, you know, getting certified on the technical side, but also pursuing the management side. So just trying to figure out what the right place was for me. And then ultimately landed on the managerial track. And that helped me solidify a couple of things. So then I knew what development programs I needed to be in and at what point in my career I needed to be in them, and sort of followed that path, that mid-level development into senior-level development. And that's when I got to do a lot of really cool things, like go over to the, what was at that time, the Information Systems Security Mission. Mm-hmm. That's where I then launched down to the White House, White House, and to work in the National Security Council doing cybersecurity stuff. And from there, I went to the National War College. So lots of great things. I know.
So many places.
Lots of things. And in the middle of all of that, September 11th happened. So lots of stuff going on.
So I'd love to know a little bit about the the National Security Council and your experience there. Can you talk a little bit about like what that is and mm-hmm. why that's so important?
Yeah, it really is. Well, first of all, I have to give a shout out to a woman named Joan Rule, who I was working for at the time in that information assurance mission tour, and who knew that I needed an external assignment to complete this development program. Mm-hmm. And she said, I know somebody, I'm going to give them a call. Right. And she didn't really tell me where at that time, it just was out of the building. I knew in Washington, out of the building. What she didn't tell me was that it was a White House out of the building. And so she called, they agreed to interview me, and I got the position working for a guy named Dick Clark, who was a senior director for what was called transnational threats back then, which was sort of everything that wasn't geographic. So think about counterterrorism, cybersecurity, weapons of mass destruction, drugs, you know, all of that stuff. And I was put on the cybersecurity team, me and one other person, Paul Kurtz, did cybersecurity. And we did it across an administration change. It's another cool thing. So I was there for the last days of President Clinton and the first 7 months or so of President Bush. There wasn't a day that I walked in that I didn't say, man, I'm in the White House. Like, that's really how cool it is. To know that you are able to influence policy and recommend things, and it doesn't take long to make things happen there. You know, a good idea quickly becomes go work it, go make it happen. And so I got to do a lot of really, really cool things. CyberCorps is a program that still exists. It was created while I was there. I actually named it. We got T-shirts for it, and got to, you know, sort of birth that, which was really, really cool. I got to brief in the sit room President Bush. Really, really cool to talk about cybersecurity stuff there when he had an interest at that point, very early in his term, because it was springtime. He wanted to talk about cybersecurity. He wanted to understand what was going on during that time. And it was just fabulous, really a great opportunity.
I like that you said that, you know, it wasn't lost on you every day you were in there. Mm-hmm. You knew how cool it is. I always say that. I actually say that about being here in D.C., like if you can't look around every time you're walking around DC and feel the weight of it, mm-hmm. then you know, maybe it's time to go.
I was like, how's she gonna finish this?
Where's it going? Yeah, I mean, yeah, I still love. I but that's not just DC. I mean, I'm from Chicago and I feel the same way. I grew up there and I love it. And every mm-hmm. time I go, I can feel it. And so I just love that you said that. That's all.
Can you sort of paint the picture for us, just like in like the environment of what it was like to brief the president? Like,
sure.
When you walk in, like, what was that experience like?
Yeah, sure. In fact, I actually have a story to tell. So there were probably six or seven of us. We were in the Situation Room, and you get there first. he gets to come in last. And so Dick Clark was very generous in that way. He took me to many places to meet many people on the Hill, in government. He was very generous with his time in that way and extending the opportunity for me to meet people and learn about issues. So he invited me and Paul to the meeting, but we didn't have a talking part.
Wait, so you walk in and you're the first.
We're the first ones there.
Do you know where you're supposed to sit?
Yes, because they're name tents.
Okay,
oh, absolutely. Good. There are name tents. Question. Yes, yes, yes. Okay. Name tents. There's a photographer in the room, and
interesting.
And so the president. This was the president, the vice president, Condi Rice and Scooter Libby, and then Dick and Paul and me. So the seven of us that in the room
is the small group.
Crazy. Small group.
Is the room big? Is it small? Is it like a big, like, is it grand? Is it kind of
grand? It's not grand. You know, it seats a good number. I mean, you've seen pictures of it.
Yeah.
Of, you know, the cabinet sitting around it.
Yeah.
And there are chairs around the edges to try to accompany hangers on or people who need other people who don't rank the table. Right. So, yep. And we just launched right in. And, you know, the shock for me was that Dick said, "So, Debbie, why don't you tell the president about X?" Holy cow. I have a speaking part.
You're like, you put me on the spot.
Oh my gosh.
So I told the president about what he had asked me to talk about. And then Dick says, well, president says, you know, good. He was pleased with it. And Dick said, you know, unfortunately, Debbie's getting ready to leave. Like, leave? President's like, leave? Yep, she's been accepted into the National War College, so she'll be leaving the end of the summer. And president says, so, National War College, cybersecurity. And he starts doing this, and I'm thinking, my life is over.
He's making the decision.
I think I'm not going to the National War College.
That's hilarious.
And I think one of the, either Dr. Rice or Libby, one of them had to leave the room for a minute. And so we're in this awkward, literally, president puts his hand down and staring, and I get bailed out by Vice President Cheney, who says, well, you know, it's a war, sorry, the war college is a wonderful opportunity and to, you know, to continue to grow and develop and to meet other peers. And the president said, okay. He said, so you come back here. Right? I'm thinking, wow, how's that going to work out for me, right? So the story gets better about a week and a half later, I get an email or a letter or something from the West Wing that says the president has decided he wants to personally thank all of the departing staff members. And they're going to do it in sort of chunks. So they'll do like one day in June is everybody who's leaving in this 30 or 60 day period. And so I saw the letter and thought, well, I will not be going. Because I've already had my opportunity, and I'm not even, I think if I go there, I may not go to the war college. This may be really, and Dick's like, you're crazy. You have to go. Debbie, you have to, you're going into the Oval. Like, you have to do this. So I was so nervous. I went, and we all lined up in the whatever color room we were in that day and got read the riot act about don't ask any questions, don't say anything. He's going to say something, then you take a picture, and then you leave, And I walk in, and he has his hand out, and I have my hand out, and he says, I know who you are, and I know where you're going. And I'm like, and so I have a wonderful picture of me, like, cheesing, like, oh, and him. Great picture that I have hanging at home.
And a good memory.
And a great memory.
Oh wow.
Such a good story.
Great memory, yeah.
So how was the war college? Do you think it was the right decision?
well, it was for a whole lot of reasons. You know, it is really where we were able to come together, you know, with senior military officers from all services, as well as senior government employees from multiple, a good number of agencies, and talk about strategy and policy. So it was, you know, challenging. It was invigorating. We had teams. We did sports. We did, you know, all types of studies and we had an elective trip in the spring, a 2-week trip, and a big day in the fall was ranking your top 5 trips, places you want to go, and they were like phenomenal choices of places to go. And we had a cadre of students from foreign nations that participated in the year, but it was a tough year because September 11th happened not long after we started. And so many, many, many of us thought we needed to be back at home. And I remember the commandant had to come and talk to all of us to encourage us to stay, that when we finished up this course, there were going to be some tired people back at home that'll be looking for some relief. And in the meantime, we could do some good work here thinking about what had happened and how we might contribute to the development of the strategy. Mm-hmm. So I stayed, and it was I still have friends from the War College, still stay in contact with folks. Great.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm.
It also feels like I've never heard a post 9/11 story like that of actually having time to think.
Well, let me just tell you. So we're sitting in seminar. Seminar is 13 students and an instructor. And we were in seminar, and it was that, you know, the morning of September 11th. And the instructor gives us a break, and his office was right next door to our seminar room. And we have a big television on the wall, but it wasn't on. And so some people were beginning to move around a little. I was still sitting in the chair. He comes running back into the room and flips on the TV. And that's when we see Jim Mikliszewski say, "The Pentagon has been hit." And we literally turn around and look out the window and see the smoke.
Oh, my gosh.
Because the college is at Fort McNair. We literally looked across water and saw the smoke. I mean, it was a lockdown. There were soldiers marching through our hallways with guns. It was, you got to get in. You got to buckle down. Okay, now you got to get out of here fast. Get in your car. Go, go, go. I mean, you know, it was a very tough time. Very tough time.
Wow. And then where did you go after that?
Right. So after that, I came back and worked on, and I was still in the SIGINT mission, working on a couple of different projects. And I did that for a while, maybe a year and a half or 2 years. And then I believe I went next to foreign relations. And I worked in the foreign relations organization with, on behalf of a couple of specific partners.
And that was at NSA?
That was at NSA.
Oh, I didn't even know they had a foreign relations office.
Well, it was our relationship. It was the U.S., the NSA relationship with those nations, our allies, mm-hmm. our friends. And so I did that for a bit, and ultimately went to the customer relationship organization, again, still in the SIGINT mission at this point. And I was the deputy in the customer relationships organization, but the plan was that I was going to become the director of it, which was sort of one level down from the SIGINT director. And then I get that, you know, that infamous phone call on a Friday night at like 6 o'clock when you're getting ready to go on a 2-week vacation. Your life is good and you're trying to finish up all the stuff you got to get done. And I get a call from the NSA deputy director saying, "So, Deb, what do you think about going over to IAD to be the deputy?" Which was a big deal anyway, because it was a big jump, I felt like, mm-hmm. from being, you know, the deputy in a customer relationships organization to going all the way over to be the deputy director. And he said, "Why don't you think about that?" And I thought, that is exactly what I want to take with me on a 2-week vacation on the beach. I'm just dying to sit on the beach and think about that, which I did. And I ended up going there to the information assurance director as a deputy, and 19 months later became the director.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's great. That really is awesome. Was it, I mean, I don't know enough about what those missions are to even know, like, were there, I'm sure they're related, right? But, were they?
They were night and day. They really were night and day. It was a totally different culture. And the director at that time, General Alexander, gave me a couple of tasks when he sent me there. And one of them was to operationalize the organization, because a lot of things were beginning to happen in this world, mm-hmm. you know, with threats and intrusions and rumors of stuff. And he recognized that we had great power and potential in this cadre of really phenomenal engineers and information system security analysts. But we weren't accustomed to operating in a real-time kind of operational way, the way our counterparts on the other side of the hallway, I say, were. So where I came from now means an hour. Like, give me something now, that means go right now. And I absolutely remember, and I've told this story before, when I had just arrived there, it was probably within my first 2 weeks, and the director was out of the office. call came down from the director's office saying he wanted a paper on a topic. And so I'm like, ooh, here's, you know, I got to figure this one out. So I find out who's responsible for that topic. And I call that leader and I say, so we, you know, director needs a paper on this topic. This is on a Tuesday. Tuesday about 11 o'clock. And the person said, okay, yep, I can get that done. And I said, so when do you think I can get that done? And they said, Thursday. And I said, how about 2 o'clock? Like today, because the director's office was calling, right? And so it's that operational piece that was not as apparent in that organization when I arrived. And the task was to, but everybody was ready. Like the workforce was ready. They recognized that they were so critical to protecting the nation's information and systems and data. So they were ready to make that move.
So I kind of want to switch gears a little bit. And I wonder if you could talk to young women who are in college or in high school now, or even in middle school, that maybe don't see themselves at NSA because they might not see that NSA would be, I don't want to say friendly to women, but not, the halls just running with lots of women. So I don't know if you want to talk about your experience about being a woman at NSA or more just speaking to these young women saying, like, you know, there is a place for you there. There are women. There are other women out there. And
right. Sure. I'd be happy to. So I am old enough to remember when I was one of a very small handful of women. As an analyst, as a junior leader, and goodness, very few minority women, very, very few. And what I can tell you today is if you walk the halls of NSA today, you see many, many women.
Mm.
And you see more minorities, men and women, than you've ever seen. And so you have to go, particularly today, when there are so many private sector entities who offer similar opportunities from a work perspective, not the same because it can't be the same.
Yeah.
Given some of the, given the work of NSA, it can't be the same. It can't be always identical, but given similar opportunities and given purses that are much bigger than the government's, they can attract a lot of young people who are taken by the opportunity to make money.
Right.
Who would blame them? And so you don't come to government to make money. You come to government because you feel the call to serve the nation.
Right.
And to give. And you know, it used to be that if you came to government and then you left, then you were a pariah almost. You weren't welcome to come back. But I really feel like that's beginning to change too. And it really has to, because you want people to come into government to learn and to understand. And go into industry and learn and understand, and then come back into government and bring that knowledge to make the whole piece better, mm-hmm. not just one or the other. So it is phenomenal work. I've always said to young people who are interested in NSA, you can literally almost be anything you'd want to be there. You like languages, we got it for you. You know, you like analysis, yeah, lots of opportunity. Engineering, computer science, management. Policy, law, you could do it all, any of that. And the thing I've really loved about it is you're not stuck in one career field once you get there. You can actually change to a different career field.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be trained. You've got to get education if it's required, but it's allowed. And so to me, that's the outside of the fact that it's the U.S. government. And so there's job security. Generally, except there's a discussion tomorrow, a vote tomorrow, I think, about furlough. But generally, it's a really secure place to work. It is family friendly. You can work flexible hours. You know, I'm not trying to do an ad for the U.S. government, but for me, it worked because when my kids were young, I was able to flex my schedule so that I would meet them at the bus in the afternoon. My husband would put them on the bus in the morning. So it was really family friendly. And to me, that was a key reason. I had offers throughout my career to come to go to other places, but none for me were as attractive as the opportunity I had at NSA, both to serve and to be around such phenomenal people.
I love that answer.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, the service piece really is so important. And I think one of the things we've talked about a lot this season is this idea of the butterfly effect of just having the ability as a single person to have this impact that at times feels like outsized, right? Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could talk about like how you feel in that service capacity, like what that really means to you and how you saw that you were able to make that ripple effect.
Right. Well, it was as a Black woman, I think it was even more impactful to me, particularly later in my career, because I knew that my career there was going to come to an end at some point. And I just knew that I had to grab some hands and I needed to find a way to not only get more people who looked like me at NSA, mm-hmm. but to make sure those people who looked like me were given opportunities, because that's the key. It's being given an opportunity. And when you then take that opportunity and can demonstrate your capabilities, that's when people recognize you and that's when they will pull you along.
Yeah.
So in my last, I guess, 15 months or so at NSA, I struck a deal with the director at that time, Admiral Rogers, and I presented to him a proposal that I would do equality. In my last 15 months, because I thought that was a place that I could make a difference and also leave a legacy. Because I knew that there were practices, but even more importantly, people who felt that they were not being treated fairly. And so he jumped at the opportunity and warmly embraced it and me. And I served as a senior advisor to him for equality in that last 15 months and was able to identify a number of initiatives and actions that he embraced and endorsed and approved in order to try to make the path easier for those coming behind me. And also to make sure that everyone felt that they were being given a fair shake.
What an amazing last tour.
Yeah. And I think I'm going to use the phrase you said, I had to grab some hands. And I love that, you know, I think we all need to do that, mm-hmm. you know?
For sure.
So, yeah, man, that was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, we, unfortunately, are coming to the end.
Right.
But we have one more question for you.
Uh-oh.
And
it's the best
question. It's the best question. And so, as you know, this podcast is called Iron Butterfly, and it's named after the first female chief of station at CIA, Eloise Page. And the men actually gave it to her because they thought she was a fierce fighter with a core of steel. So what we like to do is ask our guests, if you could give yourself a code name, what would it be and why?
Right. Right. So this is hard, right? but one image that keeps resonating with me as I've thought about this is a scale, because I have a strong sense of fairness. And I really always have. And I know it can't always be equal. I understand that. But I have tried to operate in a space of fairness. The other space I am known to have operated in, people who know me will say that, they say this all the time, that I was firm, but fair. And I'm actually okay with that. So I think a scale is definitely part of that. And I think maybe, something firm, you know, I want to say a brick, but that sounds horrible. Something else that's firm, a wooden scale maybe, or, you know, something like that. That
steel.
Resilience, steel scale, you know, something that's resilient.
Yeah.
That withstands pressure.
Yeah.
That can shine every once in a while.
So that's steel. I like steel.
Yeah. But the scale part's important too.
Cause yeah.
It's that balance. It's both fairness, but it's balance. And balance for me, has very much been important over the past, especially post-retirement years.
Well, that was really thoughtful.
It was.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
I mean, thank you for coming. It was really great to get to know you. And, you know, of course, thank you for your service to our country. And now you're an Iron Butterfly. So welcome to the we call it the kaleidoscope of butterflies.
That's right.
So thank you again.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
We loved having you. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been an episode of Iron Butterfly Podcast. We want to thank the National Security Institute at George Mason Scalia Law School, our founding sponsor, and Amazing Women of the IC for their promotion. To learn more about Iron Butterfly Media, visit our website at www.ironbutterflymedia.com. You can also learn more about NSI and upcoming events at nationalsecurity.gmu.edu. And to find out more about AWIC, email amazingwomen.ic@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe. Lastly, we want to thank our podcast producer, Amanda Young, and the entire Iron Butterfly team. Stay fierce, and we'll talk next time.